Bit different tonight, different from my normal Bible teaching style. I'm going to speak about the Western mindset. I'm going to give a lot of stories, anecdotes, illustrations out of my own experience over the last number of years. In fact, all the things I'm going to mention tonight have occurred within the last 2 years, so they're all fairly fresh. But what am I going to talk about? I'm thinking of how every nation in the world sees the world as only two lots of people, ourselves and the rest. Now here are we in Australia, just a fairly small country of 20 million people, but there are only two types of people in the world, us and foreigners. And so all the rest, how many billion, I've forgotten, but there's us and the rest of them are foreigners. And that is true of every country in the world. When you arrive at an airport, you'll see a sign that says nationals of that country and the rest foreigners. The Jews, of course, saw the world in the same way. There were only two lots of people, Jews and Gentiles. But how many Jews were there? Well, very few, comparatively speaking. At the most, a few million, even at the peak of their national development. But out there, millions upon millions, the rest all lumped together under one category, Gentiles. Because of this, it colours our thinking, and we can't really understand that people outside our set see things differently. Not only do we not understand them, but we tend to despise them, to look down upon them. This again is common right through the human race, and it always seems to have been there. In biblical times, the Greeks saw everybody else as barbarians. The Greeks seek after wisdom, we are told in Corinthians chapter 1. The rest, barbarians. Paul uses the expression actually in Romans chapter 1. That's the way they saw things. The Greeks despised the barbarians. The Jews despised the Samaritans. If you just think of the incident where Jesus meets the Samaritan woman, she was surprised that Jesus would speak with her, a Samaritan, because normally the Jews would have no dealings with the Samaritans. And later on in John's Gospel, where the local people, the Jewish people, wanted to call Jesus by a rude name, a swear word they wanted to use with him, the worst that they could think of was to call him a Samaritan. One of these terms that has ugly racial overtones. I've learnt, having lived in various countries, and especially my time in Thailand, where of course you speak the local language and understand what's going on, and you find that you're the butt of some of their racist jokes. That's why I am not very tolerant of racist jokes that I hear in this country. When you're on the receiving end of these jokes, and you can understand that you're the butt of words that are being said that you may not have understood had you not understood the local language, you become more sensitive to these issues and try not to treat others the way you yourself would prefer not to be treated. The Jews despise the Samaritans, and they use these crude expressions in speaking of Jesus. The Jewish Christians despised the Gentile Christians. In fact, before we get that far, we have the story in the book of Acts where Peter had great difficulty grasping that God could work through the Gentiles. And when he was sent to Caesarea, to the house of Cornelius, he was amazed that these people who were Gentiles, they were Romans and hangers-on of the non-Jewish population. It says that Peter and those who came with him from Jerusalem, other Jews, they were amazed because the gift of the Holy Spirit had been poured out even on the Gentiles. Goodness me, fancy even these people having the Holy Spirit the same as we had it. And when you come to the book of Romans, which was why we had that reading earlier, we see this way the Jewish Christians despise the Gentile Christians, and the Gentile Christians criticize the Jewish Christians. We have in Romans chapter 14, let not him who eats despise him who abstains. One despised the other because some people ate vegetarian food or had other dietary restrictions, and they despised people who didn't share their view. On the other hand, those who did not eat, they passed judgment on those who did. They couldn't see the other person's point of view. And that's why I had that reading at the beginning from Romans 15, where Paul is saying that Christ became a servant to the circumcised, that is to the Jews, to show God's truthfulness in order to confirm the promises given to the patriarchs in order that the Gentiles might glorify God. And as you read through the next number of verses, the emphasis is on the word Gentiles. I'll read it again. That the Gentiles might glorify God, as it is written, therefore I will praise you among the Gentiles and sing to your name. And again it is said, rejoice, O Gentiles, with his people. And again, praise the Lord, all Gentiles, and let the peoples praise him. Isaiah says, the root of Jesse shall come, he who rises to rule the Gentiles, in him shall the Gentiles hope. The emphasis is that God is doing something that they didn't expect. And this grace of God has gone to the Gentiles. And the Jewish people simply could not understand that others were capable of the same sort of spirituality, the same spiritual appreciation, the same understanding, the same capacity as they had. And so it is with us, that we have an unspoken assumption at times that we are superior. And I'm not saying this as a particular criticism of this congregation or even of this nation. I'm just saying it's true of people everywhere, but it is particularly true of people in the West. We have a Western mindset which has adopted a feeling of superiority that sees ourselves as the guardians of the most advanced civilization the world has ever seen, and therefore tending to despise those who are not of our set. Now, I'm just going to give you a lot of illustrations. As I said, these are all fairly fresh. They've come in the last few years. And they betray a mindset. The people who use these expressions don't use them in a critical or a nasty or a racist sense. They use them without thinking, and in using them, they show the sort of mindset they have. Now, for example, I was showing some slides of a visit recently to Nepal, and I was lecturing at several Bible schools. These bush Bible schools they have scattered around the capital city there, 20, 30 people in each. And each day I lectured in three of them. And so it'd be 8 o'clock in the morning and I'd lecture for an hour or so. Then I'd walk my way back. I worked my route out very quickly after I'd got there. I found my way around the city. A lot of lanes in Kathmandu, it's a cute setup. You dive down this lane, turn left, go through that one, turn right, turn left. Picking my way through all these lanes and then get to the second place, which is about 2 kilometres away. Lecture there. Then go to the third place, which is a couple of kilometres again. I just showed a few pictures and mentioned this. In the question session afterwards, somebody raised the question and said, don't you feel at risk? Don't you feel some danger walking through all these lanes like that in a city you don't know? I was a bit taken aback because honestly, it had never crossed my mind. I said, I never thought of it. But you see, what was in that person's mind was different sort of people. They don't speak our language, they look different. They're either Chinese looking or they're Indian looking, but they certainly look different. And in some way, you're exposed to danger walking around these lanes. Honestly, I go into lots and lots of countries, and really, I don't feel any danger. In fact, the only place I've really been in danger of getting a good mugging was right here in Brisbane, where I'd come home late at night on an interstate coach. I was at the terminal there in Roma Street, and I was set upon by 2 youths who were going to do me over properly. I won't go into the story, but at least I was rescued from a good mugging. That's the only time I've been in danger, and that was among people who looked and spoke the same as we do. They were Aussies. When I was telling somebody else about this work in Nepal that I just come from, and how the church has grown and the great vitality that is being seen there, as this church is coming out of almost non-existence 10 years ago into quite a vibrant ministry. There are churches growing everywhere. And then the person said to me, how many workers are there? And I said, oh, 20,000 of them, 30,000. And then she smiled and said, oh, you know what I mean. Yes, I knew what she meant. She meant, were there foreign missionaries there? I didn't see a single foreign missionary. It wasn't why I was there. I suppose they are there doing something. But you see, the mentality was, this great growth is taking place. Who are the workers? Meaning the only workers are the imported missionaries from outside. But the local people are doing it all. I've said sometimes, in some of these countries, if you picked all the foreign missionaries up, all the Western missionaries, and dropped them in the ocean, you wouldn't even notice that they'd gone, in terms of the overall work of the country. Now, don't get me wrong, I'm not rubbishing the entire missionary force. But let's take a parallel. Supposing you take me here, in Australia, you take me and you can think of 3 or 4 other reasonably well-known people that have wide ministries, and you dropped us in the ocean. It would make no difference to the overall state of the church in this country. It would make no difference to the overall state of this particular denomination in this country, or even in this state or even in this city. It may make a difference with a few ministries we're involved in, and maybe one or two churches might miss us, but even within this city of Brisbane here, it would virtually make no difference to the overall strength and structure and functioning of the church. Because the church is not dependent on two or three people doing something, it's dependent on the thousands of people that make up all the congregations, with all the workers and the leaders and the active people in those congregations. That is the way it is around the world. The energy and the drive and the work that's being done in country after country after country is not dependent on foreign missionaries. It's all being done by the local people there. So that's what I mean when I say if you drop these missionaries in the ocean, you wouldn't even miss them. Individuals may, of course. But one other person, I was telling this person something of the growth in Nepal, and he said, but there must have been somebody. How did it start? And I said, oh, just a few Nepalis, I suppose. He said, but there must be some missionaries there. And I said, why? Well, he said, somebody's got to start it. But I said, there have been Christians there before. Going back 10 years or so, there were a few hundred Christians, or even if not a few hundred, let's say 100. Now, of course, there are 100,000 of them. But let's say there are only 100. Well, you don't even need 100 to start something, even if there's only 5 or 10. Why can't they start something? Why does it have to be 5 or 10 missionaries from the Western world that are going to start something? Why could not have been just 5 or 10 among the local people that started it? Which in fact was the way it was. But you see the mindset we have. We cannot understand what's happening in many countries. We can only see things in terms of the white missionary force that happens to be in that country. Look at China. Now China, 50 years ago, all the missionaries were expelled from the country when the communists took over. Okay, they had planted a church and they had Christians around the country. But the dramatic growth that's happened in China, nothing like this has happened in the history of the church. The growth in China in the last 50 years is the most spectacular church growth event in the history of the church. And there hasn't been a missionary or an expatriate, white, European, Western person in sight. It's all come out of those local people. And so why can't it happen in any other country? But you see, we have a mindset that says, oh, there must be some missionaries there doing it or providing the initiative. No. In most cases, it's happening completely out of the environment of the local church. When Gay was in hospital last year, one of the nurses that was talking there, and it turned out she was a Christian, and she found that I just got back from Yugoslavia. And I was telling her about how things in Yugoslavia have gone ahead. And this great ministry that started, it started through one Brethren man and one Baptist man. Both the Brethren and the Baptist were fairly bogged down in traditionalism, manning the trenches, defending the barracks against the inroads of communism and so on. And in the process, over those 50 years of communism, the church became bogged down, it became negative and legalistic, and when freedom came, they didn't know what to do with it. And these men broke loose and they started to reach out to children, to youth, to other people, to start ministries in schools, to start ministries in radio. Then it spread, and it spread across the land, and in a fairly unspectacular way, it has just grown and grown. From those two men with some vision has come a change in the churches. There's now a Bible school. They've now sent over 100 graduates of that Bible school into the areas of former Yugoslavia where Christians never went before, because they're Croats and these are Serbs and they're Bosnians and they're someone else. They all kept to themselves and nobody evangelized anybody. But out of the vision of these two men is quite a work now that has spread and grown, and they have developed a ministry with many other helpers doing a great work for God there. When I told this woman, she said, oh, which mission was a part of? And I said, no mission, it was just a couple of local Christians. But she said, it must have been some mission. And I said, no, it wasn't. She said, was it the ECM, European Christian Mission? I said, no, it wasn't. Well, she said, was it Slavic Gospel Association? I said, no, it wasn't Slavic Gospel Association. And so I tried to explain more and she listened. And then she said, does that have anything to do with Open Doors, Brother Andrew's ministry? I said, no. I just couldn't get through to her. She obviously had no mechanism in her head that could accommodate the fact that all of this could happen without being initiated by some missionary operation from the West. It's not only Christians that have this problem. There was a series on TV, I forget the name of it, it was a documentary series. It was looking at some things in the past and among them was India. It went back to the colonial period, pre-war or during World War II, and the commentator made this comment. He said 300 million Indians had their country governed for them by 3,000 British. That mentality still persists. Now, it may have been true to some degree in those days, although we must admit that those 3,000 British didn't administer the whole country because they had a whole army of civil servants who were doing most of the work. But the context in which it was said, and the attitude of many people I meet today, is that the only things that are happening in some of these countries around the world are those that have been initiated by somebody from the Western world. And this is reinforced when we see aid agencies in some country where there's been a disaster, and the people that speak on camera are nearly always the white people, because they've been sent from Sweden or America or Australia or Britain or someplace, and so they're the ones that speak. And we get this impression that these people can only have anything done if it's done for them by people from the West, which is really a distortion of the truth. But it carries across into the church. And so the mentality is that somehow these churches are all dependent on missionaries. You can go to country after country, and there can be 1,000 churches and not a single missionary among them. And they're all growing and expanding. But you see, over the decades, going back to a former generation, we have been conditioned to a way of thinking that is completely out of step with the way things are in this day and age. In the last 20, 25 years, such a revolution in world mission. I think most people here are totally unaware of it. Even the expressions that are used. Here's another one. This was on Burke's Backyard, a good old gardening program on Friday evening. And every now and again, Don Burke, he takes an excursion somewhere, and he'd been across to Crete or Cyprus or Malta or some place in the Mediterranean region. In the course of his talk, he said something about the known world. He said, oh, this was something, something, and he mentioned the known world. And I thought, well, there it is, an ordinary secular program, and this person is using an expression that should never be used, the known world. What do they mean when they say the known world? They mean known by Europeans. If it's not known by Europeans, apparently it's unknown. But the people who lived there knew about it, and lots of other people knew about it. The European world, the Mediterranean world, is the known world, only because it's known to Europeans. The rest of it outside that world is the unknown world, because it's unknown to Europeans. And so the European mindset governs the thinking and the attitudes of people. I can remember sitting through churches, in fact it probably still happens now, where people will go through the visions of Daniel in the four world empires, they call them, Babylon, Persia, Greece and Rome, and these were the four world empires. I believed all that until one day I discovered that they weren't world empires at all. They were Mesopotamian come Mediterranean empires. The Babylonian empire started in Mesopotamia and stretched across to the Mediterranean. That's it. It wasn't a world empire. In fact, if you look at the area of the Babylonian empire, it was only about half the size of the state of Queensland, which is nothing like a world empire. And then you have the Persian, which was bigger, the Greeks and the Roman. But when you look at them, they were all just around the Mediterranean region, stretching into Mesopotamia or coming the other way from Mesopotamia into the Mediterranean. But you can see the mindset. Because we are European, and because our history and our heritage and our forebears have come from Europe, that is the world. And it comes across in the terminology we still use. Now, some of it, of course, we're stuck with, like Near East, Middle East and Far East. Okay, we've got to live with that, I suppose. But Near East, Middle East, Far East in relation to what? In relation to Europe, of course. That is why we have a distorted view of the world. And that is why so many Christians simply cannot come to terms with the fact that we are outnumbered 3-1. We, meaning the European Christians, the Western world Christians, we're outnumbered more than 3-1. By Christians from the Afro-Asian come Latin American world. I heard this one only about 2 weeks ago. Somebody was talking to me about certain countries in Africa and some of the troubles that they are going through. You don't need me to repeat some of these troubles. You see them on TV. We know the crises that some of these countries are in right now. This person said to me, the trouble was we gave them independence too soon. Now, when he says we, he didn't mean Australia, because we didn't colonise those countries. I think we only had Papua New Guinea. But we was identification with the British who had colonised these countries. But the point was, had given them their independence too soon. And I almost fell over. Gave them their independence too soon? Why do we ever take their independence from them? We should never have had control of those countries. Britain or whatever colonial power it was, whether it was Germany or France or Spain or Portugal or whoever, they simply went in and they said, we're claiming this in the name of the country, and they took control because they had firepower and the locals had no answer to it. And so for the next number of decades, which may have stretched to 50 years, 60 years, they ruled those countries. And then, because of changing times in the period following World War II, they gave them back their independence. But they had no right to take that independence from them in the first place. Now, I'm surprised at how gracious the people in some of these countries are, honestly. I see no bitterness, I see a degree of forgiveness that I don't see in our own country. In fact, we can just think of something more recent, such as Nelson Mandela, and how he kept the lid on South Africa. That whole place could have blown apart, and yet here's a man who's been locked up for 26 years unjustly, and yet he can be counselling reconciliation and patience and forgiveness and forbearance and putting the past behind us. And yet I see people in our own country that keep on digging up bits and pieces out of World War II and showing a hatred and a spitefulness there that you think, goodness me, some of these, they call themselves Christians. And yet I can go to countries where the people may or may not be Christian, and they show a degree of forgiveness and tolerance, prepared to put the past behind and move forward, that we could well learn from. Remember, I was in India a number of years ago. I was in Bangalore and I saw on one side of the street a statue of Queen Victoria, and on the other side was a statue of Mahatma Gandhi. I commented about this to an Indian and I said, goodness me, is it you having that woman there looking across the road at Mahatma Gandhi? I said, it's a wonder you hadn't toppled all those statues by now. He said, oh, we toppled a few of them. And he said, but we've got them dotted all around the place. They're part of our history. And he says, we're grateful for some of the things the British brought. They should never have come here. We are glad to see them go, but we appreciate some of the things they left behind. The structure of government, the railway system, other developmental businesses. They show an appreciation. I was in a country of Africa, Zambia it was. This was only a few months ago. I was with a group of Zambian church leaders. It was the night before he left, and they were just having a bit of a send-off, and half a dozen of us there were having the evening together. And in the room next door, somebody was watching TV, and there was a football match on. And every now and again, you'd hear this great roar go up and somebody scored a goal. Somebody at the table couldn't wait any longer, so had to go off to find out what the score was. It was a match between England and Germany. So I asked the fellows, I said, well, that's interesting. I said, who would you cheer for? They all said England. There was still some appreciation of the heritage that they had come into. Even though those colonial powers ripped off these countries, why is it that some of these countries like England were so powerful, were so wealthy, until they dismantled their empire? And then they became second-rate powers, economically and otherwise as well. It's quite obvious where they gained their illegitimate wealth from, as they exploited countries all around. The Soviets did the same, as they exploited all those countries in Eastern Europe. And as soon as Eastern Europe became independent of Russia, Russia went flat, because they had been bleeding those countries dry when they took over control of them. I'm off the subject here. Let's come back. Yes, that was this bit about giving independence too soon. But you see, it showed a mindset that we have a right to determine when to give people independence. I mean, here we are in a country that really, we don't belong here. It wasn't ours originally. But a few hundred years ago, somebody came along and hoisted the British flag and said, in the name of the king, we claim this land. Never mind the people who lived here, who'd lived here for tens of thousands of years, simply took it from them. And here we are now, we're stuck with it. One can't undo a lot of the things that have happened over centuries and centuries, but it's the mentality I'm talking about. And we've got to see that we don't perpetuate a wrong mentality. I see this sometimes in magazines, where you'll get news from a missionary published in a magazine, and they talk about some of the immorality that has happened in the local church. Somebody had to be disciplined. When that happens at home, we don't send a message around all the churches. When there's been some dishonesty in the funds, or been a fight or a squabble or a split in the church, or something unpleasant has happened, we try to keep it quiet. We certainly don't brag about it. But when it happens in other countries, it happens to other churches, it's a news item which is spread around for the consumption of the Western reading world in our missionary magazines. These things, I think, are distasteful. I think they're indiscreet, and we ought not to do it. In fact, I read one, this only happened a couple of months ago, in the missionary magazine that most of us here get. This person was writing, and he said, we had a missionary get-together, the missionaries discussing something, and they wanted to do this and this and something else, but they said the Koreans couldn't agree. Now, they wouldn't have said, if there was a group, let's say, of a few missionaries, some from Australia, from New Zealand, from England and Scotland, let's say, they wouldn't have said, well, we wanted to do this, but the Scottish wouldn't agree to it, or the New Zealanders didn't like it. You would just say, we couldn't get agreement. But the Koreans, they're not European, you see. And here it was, put in black and white, but the Koreans couldn't agree. And the assumption was, of course, that the Koreans were a bit out of step and that they shouldn't have done that. We have two standards. We have one that we apply to ourselves, but when it is concerning people who look different, who speak a different language, come from a different ethnic or cultural background, we seem to think that we can speak about them in a way that we have license to do. We ought not to do it. I hear comments made sometimes about people believing in great numbers in Africa and Latin America and Asia because they are not so well educated. Now, I've heard this said a couple of times, and I blow up when I hear this said to me. I find it very difficult to contain my anger. Almost as if they're saying, oh, those people are, you know, they're fairly simple-minded, they'd believe anything. Simple-minded! You look at the things that people in this country watch on TV, you hear the pathetic gossip that people accept. They listen to John Laws and Alan Jones and these gurus that are on talkback radio, and they actually believe what these people are saying. People are so gullible, and then we think other people are gullible. Goodness me, when you look at the mentality of this country, you look at what's served up on commercial TV, what's served up on TV in general, or what's served up in advertising or in magazines, the tripe, the trash, but this is the daily fare of most people in this country. And then people have the hide to cast aspersions on somebody in another country as if they would believe too easily, as if they're easily conned into believing something. I will say one thing, though, about these countries. They learn a greater trust in God because they're not trusting in other things. One of the problems in our country is, of course, that we have so much. We don't need God. In fact, even in our churches, most Christians could live without God. If, hypothetically, God disappeared from the scene, it would make very little difference to the way most Christians live. It would make very little difference to the way most churches function because we have learned to live without faith. We have no more need to pray the prayer, give us this day our daily bread, because we've already got it. It's in the fridge, and if it's not in the fridge, it's in the freezer. And if it's not there, there's a supermarket down the street, and we've all got loads of money to get what we need. But in many places in the world, it's literally true. Give us this day our daily bread. Because that is the way they have to survive. When I was in a country of Africa just last year, one of the men said to me there, local man, he said, we have to pray because it's the only way we can get anything to work. He said, here we are in this conference. He said, we had to pray like mad every day just for the power to stay on. We never think about that in this country. We take it for granted that the power will stay on. He said, we post a letter. We've got to pray, pray, pray that that letter will get to its destination. And so it goes on. They are cast upon God. I was in Burma a couple of years ago, and a woman, she brought this baby. She wanted to pray over it. And quite often people will do this. But I mentioned Burma because it is the worst country in the world. According to a United Nations survey of over 170 countries, its medical services were the worst in the world. Mostly, you'll find the countries of Africa are at the bottom of the scale when it comes to economic progress or development. But when it comes to health, Burma is the worst. You can't even get aspirin quite often. It is just a hopeless place, and the hospitals are awful. But you see, they have nothing else, so they've got to pray. We automatically just go to the doctor. Go and buy some medicine. That's our first thought. But that's not their first thought. Their first thought is prayer. Coming back to these people, there's nothing wrong with their intelligence. In fact, if you look at intelligence, I think some of us might have cause to query our own intelligence. Some people gauge intelligence according to the way people look. Some people speak English not perfectly. And so because their English is not perfect, we tend to think that their mental processes are not all that good. But it's their second language, their third language, their fourth language in some cases. And most of us can only speak one language anyway. If you take literacy as a test of intelligence, then you're on the wrong track. I know some people who are illiterate but very intelligent. I know some people who are literate and not very intelligent at all. We are literate in this country simply because the education system sees us go through school and learn how to read and write. But for many people in the world, that doesn't apply. And it's nothing to do with their intelligence. It's simply they have not had the opportunity. Supposing you took linguistic ability as a test of intelligence, the English-speaking world would be the worst. We would be the dumbest people on the planet because most of us can only speak one language. And when it comes to learning another, we are not very clever in general. Whereas most other people, they can quite readily learn a second or a third language. Many of them speak two or three languages, read or write two or three languages. And so if you took that as a test of intelligence, then we are the ones that fare badly. But you see, there's a mindset that says because the person's English is not as fluent as mine, therefore his intelligence is not as good as mine. Sometimes they can't speak English at all. We had a case in Thailand of a man who wrote a letter of sympathy to my mother when my father died very suddenly. This is going back 30-something years now, 35 years, when we were in Thailand. And he wrote a letter. Man can't speak English. And I translated it into English and posted it to my mother. A friend of the family read it. He wrote back and said, what a wonderful letter it was, how moving it was. He said, I just wonder how much of that was put down to your translation. Because he said, I can't imagine he could speak English that well. I tried to explain it by letter, but when I got home on leave, I talked to this man and tried to explain to him. I said, nothing to do with it. Of course his English isn't that good. His English is non-existent because he can't speak English. But he speaks very good Thai. He's a Thai person. He's very articulate. And so he wrote this very impressive letter, and I translated as best I could into corresponding English. But he still couldn't get the point. He said, I can't speak as fluently as that. You see, he can only think in terms of expressions in English and can't understand that people speaking their own language may be 10 times better in their language than we are in English. When we hear them speak English, I've even heard people laugh at them because they don't speak it quite the way we do. On the other side of the scale, we look at our prosperity. And because we're cleaned up, respectable middle-class citizens, and our streets are clean and everything is tidy and neat and well-ordered, this is largely the product of the sort of society we live in. It's got nothing to do with intelligence or morality, and certainly nothing much to do with the level of our spirituality. But people think it has. I showed some pictures once, and a comment one man made afterwards was, oh, I love seeing the pictures of those Christians in that particular country. He said, you know the thing I liked most? He said, they were dressed like us. And I thought, oh, goodness me. That was his way of judging. If they had been dressed in their local garb, he must have thought this was in some way wrong, as if somehow the way we dress is the biblical way. I don't know what he did with all the pictures of Jesus and his 12 apostles getting around in dressing gowns or whatever the garb happened to be. You see, there was a mental block there. He could only think of Western civilization and Western habits and cultural practices as being right, and anything else was wrong. But here we are, we don't know as much about adversity as those people, and consequently our Christianity is weak and flabby, whereas the Christianity of these other people that has been tried and tested is very often strong. And we're so self-sufficient that we not only don't need each other, we don't even need God. That's in the backs of our minds. But when you meet people who need each other and who need God, you'll find a healthy, virile, spiritual life. So much for the Western mindset. Let me just conclude this by coming back to Paul. He was the first world Christian. That was an expression I heard somebody use at an international conference I was at in Singapore some years ago. And I thought, oh, that's a good expression. That's what I want to be, a world Christian. Not an Australian Christian. I get so annoyed when I'm in a country and you'll meet somebody else who's an Australian and people are introducing themselves, I'm from England, I'm from Australia, I'm from New Zealand or some other place. And they say it in a way as if everybody's got to start licking their boots or as if this is something to be proud of. Or even within this country, you'll be at an interstate meeting, introduce yourself around, I'm from Sydney, I'm from Tasmania, God's own country, I'm from Queensland, I'm a Queenslander and proud of it. And I think, oh, drop dead, you people. You get so annoyed at this petty parochialism, but it betrays a mindset. I just happened to be born in this country. That's about it. Actually, I took a visitor from New Zealand I shouldn't say New Zealand there because we're just as bad, let's say from another country, up the mountains here outside Brisbane. And he made some comments to the effect that these mountains were not proper mountains, but they had really proper mountains in their country. I got a bit sick of this all the time, so I said to him, what did you make them? And he looked at me a bit blank. But you see, this is the mentality, is somehow we've got to be proud of these national things. I don't want to be a nationalist Christian. I want to be a world Christian, and Paul was a world Christian. As I started to say something about the book of Colossians. Because here was a church that was started by non-Jewish people. He said, you learned the gospel from Epaphras, our beloved brother. Epaphras was a local, we'd call him a Turk today. He wasn't a Jew. He was born and bred in the region. He was the one that started the church there in Colossae. Not only did he start the church, but he was mainly responsible for its growth. Epaphras, who is one of yourselves, a servant of Christ Jesus, greets you, always remembering you earnestly in your prayers, that you may stand mature and fully assured in all the will of God. I bear him witness. He has worked hard for you and for those in Laodicea and Hierapolis. A world Christian. Not a Jewish Christian, not this Christian, not anything else. That's why Paul was so out of step with his fellow Jews. Because he had risen above this petty nationalism. Looking down your nose at somebody who doesn't do things the way you do. That's why I referred to some of those references in the book of Romans. That they hated him. That his own people hated him. Because it seemed that he had sold out on the Jewish nation, the Jewish race and the Jewish religion. But he wasn't interested. He had a bigger world, a bigger vision, and I just hope that that's what we can have. I've just given you a lot of little miscellaneous anecdotes and comments here tonight, but I hope that they in some way contribute to making us think about how we see other people and to get rid of this Western mindset, to set about dismantling it so that we are no longer narrow-minded in the sense that these people were. When Paul finally came to Jerusalem, he stood before the Jewish crowd there and he gave an account of himself, of his conversion, and how God had directed him into this work. He spoke in the local language, so they understood him, and they gave him rapt attention as he recounted his experiences, until he got to the point where he said, and then God said to me, depart, I'm going to send you far away to the Gentiles. Up to this point, they listened. And then they lifted up their voices and said, away with such a fellow from the earth, he ought not to live. And they would have killed him because of that. There's no doubt that these racial nationalistic features of human nature go very deep. And they are the cause of most of the wars and conflict right around the world. I'm not saying the Western world is the only part of the world that has this problem. I believe every nation and every ethnic group has the same problem. But we, you and I, belong to this particular ethnic group here, this particular country. And whatever other people may be doing, you and I have an obligation upon us to work hard at changing our attitude, changing our viewpoint, and to realize that the world has changed. It's not the world it used to be. And we have got to see that these changes have been for the glory of God. The church is the truly international body in the world. It's growing at a greater rate than it has ever grown since apostolic times. We want to be part of it. We want to join with our brothers and sisters, join hands with them, and with them rejoice in what God is doing, and help them in whatever way possible, and realize that there is so much we can learn from them. I go to many of these countries, and I impart some biblical knowledge, but I always come away having learnt more than I taught, and I trust that I will continue to go on learning.